ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, Tegan Taylor here from Life Matters. Do you rely on grandparents to help pay the bills or look after the kids? You're not alone. Life has gotten busier, more expensive, and grandparents are picking up the slack. This July on Radio National, The Grandparent Trap explores the changing role of grandparents in modern family life. The Grandparent Trap and much more on Life Matters. Search for Life Matters on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let me take you back to the year 1994. And honestly, what a year.
MTV News.
Kurt Cobain dies.
Cobain, who was 27, had reportedly been missing for several days.
Nelson Mandela is elected president of South Africa.
And joy that we can loudly proclaim, free at last.
The first episode of Friends airs. Pulp Fiction, Forrest Gump, Shawshank Redemption, The Lion King all hit cinemas.
For Hollywood, a night of celebration and backslapping in the movie industry's biggest night of the year.
And Pizza Hut delivers its first online order.
Dougie, how are you, mate?
Good.
And there's your two large pizzas at $16.90.
Beautiful.
As cheesy as it is, this is a pivotal moment in history. In 1994, the World Wide Web as we know it is only a year old. It has a whopping 2,000 websites.
It's the world's biggest computer network.
And we're still figuring out what this internet will be. A place for doing business? For socialising? For buying things?
All of a sudden, I can sit here on the internet and buy goods.
Conference delegates are being told the internet and the web will soon become the primary medium for consumers and businesses.
And unlike commercial networks, no one owns it, no one controls it, and no one can stop it.
The internet is a bit haphazard, more cowboy than corporate.
In fact, we were thinking the internet's really cool. We can share all our information and talk to everybody. We had no idea about hackers and all the stuff that's happened since.
But then, something big happens in 1994, and it puts the World Wide Web under threat. It isn't a hijacked network or a computer virus. It's a mathematical algorithm.
I thought, this is almost unbelievable. It's almost like the atomic bomb in terms of its transformational effect on society.
Luckily, this algorithm can only run on a quantum computer that doesn't exist yet.
I didn't know what a big deal it was going to be. I didn't know it was going to define research programs of nation states for decades to follow. I had no idea what we were starting of that scope.
This is Dead and Alive, a new series of science fiction for ABC Radio National. I'm Jacinta Bowler, and I'm trying to find out if quantum computers will change the world. This episode, the surprising tale of how they almost broke the internet. Episode 2, Quantum Attack.
Sometimes you get lucky, you get in the right place at the right time. As my old thesis advisor said, give yourself a chance to get lucky, and I certainly gave myself that chance.
As you can hear, physicist Henry Everett is a cheerful guy, and this is even when he's staring down an existential threat. In 1994, he was in his early 30s, starting off his scientific career in the US Army, and a colleague got in touch about a paper that had just been written. It was called Polynomial Time Algorithms for Prime Factorization and Discrete Logarithms on a Quantum Computer. Henry was a bit lost, and understandably so.
I didn't know enough to understand significantly how important this stuff was. I had to do a lot of homework.
The issue here that Henry was missing at the time was something called public key encryption. It's a bit complicated, but it's a system that uses numbers to keep information hidden. It protects army secrets, confidential government documents, and since the 90s, your information online.
Most public transactions, financial transactions, you buy something from Amazon, for example, you'll notice in the web browser it says HTTPS. S means secure. It means you're using something called public key encryption.
It's kind of like a handshake between your computer and the rest of the web. I've got to break it to you, though. It takes a small amount of maths to understand. Okay, class, here we go. Say you have two prime numbers. I'll go with 7 and 11. When you multiply those numbers, you get a bigger number. 7 times 11 is 77. If you're then asked to find the factors of 77, meaning find the two numbers that are multiplied to make 77, it's not that hard to work out that it's 7 times 11. An easy calculation when the numbers are small.
Public key encryption works because the prime numbers that we use are enormous. And so the product is enormous squared. It's a gigantic number. So big, in fact, that it would take roughly the age of the universe for our current computers to find those two prime cofactors.
It's not impossible, just incredibly difficult. And it gets more difficult the larger the number.
And I feel really good about that because one of the real nice attributes about public key encryption is if your computer gets faster and faster and now you can break my enormous key, I can just get a bigger prime number tomorrow and it's going to be exponentially harder for you to break it.
This was the case until a man called Peter Shaw came on the scene. Peter is no hacker. He's a computer scientist, and in 1994, he's playing around, trying to figure out what this far-flung idea of a quantum computer might be good for. After days in the library, he starts writing. Polynomial time algorithms for prime factorization and discrete logarithms on a quantum computer. This is now better known as Shaw's algorithm.
Peter's an interesting guy. He's brilliant, obviously. My conversations with him were very down to earth.
Peter Shaw writes poems, translates French, and thanks folk dancers in the acknowledgements of his PhD. But I don't think anything gives you quite as much insight into Peter Shaw as this limerick he wrote to explain his own algorithm.
If the computers that you build are quantum, then spies of all factions will want them. Our codes will all fail, and they'll read our email till we've crypto that's quantum and dauntum.
Said far less lyrically, Shaw's algorithm can run on a quantum computer and break public key encryption. Our emails, online shopping carts, credit card information, all toast.
That would bring our financial markets and electronic commerce to a grinding halt. That's how disruptive it would be if a quantum computer was built and we had to throw out public key encryption.
By all accounts, Peter didn't set out to break the internet. He just wanted to see if a quantum computer could be any better than a regular computer at solving this mathematical conundrum. And he was right. Those big numbers our regular computers struggle to crack? Piece of cake for a quantum computer running Shaw's algorithm. Back in 1994, Henry was in the process of finding this out too.
So if I make my number bigger and the computation gets exponentially harder, well, guess what? My computer gets exponentially faster. That's what a quantum computer does, and that's what Shaw's algorithm takes advantage of.
Shaw's algorithm is able to crack everything that uses public key encryption. So while I might be thinking about someone exposing my Pizza Hut order or an ex reading my emails, Henry is contemplating more significant implications. Army secrets or classified government documents.
The good news, if you're a code breaker, is that I can break your codes. The bad news is if you're trying to transmit secure information, oh no, it's not secure anymore. So depending on which side of that you're on, you're either really excited about a quantum computer or you're really concerned about it.
Because Henry works for the US Army, he's both. The ability to crack the codes of his enemies? Great. The ability for his enemies to crack his codes? Not so great. In 1994, Henry had been planning a small quantum workshop at the University of Arizona. He imagined it was all going to be pretty low key. At this point, quantum is a very niche field with some limited applications for defense. But then, just 3 months before the workshop, Shaw's algorithm comes out, and suddenly quantum poses a major threat to national security. Henry's in way over his head and turns to another government department for a helping hand.
One of the most exciting aspects of that was that I made new friends in an agency I'd never worked with before, the National Security Agency.
as in the Agency for American Spies.
And I didn't know anybody in there. They're super secret. They live in a box and I don't get to talk to those people. So I had to ask my boss, do you know anybody in the box that I could call up and ask them if they're interested in this subject? And he connected me to somebody who connected me to somebody who connected me to somebody who said, yes, I'm the right person. I'll be coming to your workshop.
The person, of course, didn't want to be named when we asked. Spies are, after all, top secret, which is exactly why encryption is critical for a spy agency. If encryption can be broken, a lot of dirty laundry ends up in your enemy's hands. The purpose of this workshop ended up being paradoxical. You would think defense and spy agencies would want to protect against this quantum threat. The sooner someone builds a quantum computer, the sooner their secrets get exposed. But actually, Henry's workshop centered around one question. How do we build a quantum computer? He figured, others are working on this. We need to get there first. If the United States doesn't build a quantum computer, its enemies will.
And there was a lot of interest. People had seen Shorter's algorithm. They immediately got the potential and they were happy to come to this workshop. Many of them came on their own dollar because they wanted to give me advice.
So, where's the man of the hour? The man who triggered all of this, Peter Shor.
As it happened, it really broke my heart. Right before the workshop, he called me up and said, Henry, I'm not going to make it. I said, what happened? He said, my basement flooded and I've got plumbers coming and I can't leave home until this is dealt with. My wife will kill me. So
he would have been so bummed.
Yes, yes.
So Shor gets to sit the workshop out. Everyone else is left to deal with the consequences of his algorithm. What was a niche field now has the attention of the United States government, and the cash starts to flow. Everyone is suddenly very invested in quantum and what it takes to protect against a quantum attack. Over 30 years later, we're still dealing with the fallout. In fact, the threat is more present now than it ever has been. On ABC Radio National, you're listening to Dead and Alive, a special series from Science Friction. I'm Jacinta Bowler. Imagine this. You're sitting in a cafe working on public Wi-Fi. Everything looks normal. You're logged into your email with HTTPS. Remember what Henry said?
S means secure. It means you're using something called public key encryption.
But somewhere between you and your email server, data is quietly being collected. A foreign spy agency or a criminal group is vacuuming up enormous amounts of your information. A scan of your passport sent to a real estate agent. Financial documents sent to your accountant. Right now, it's being protected by public key encryption, so it's just a jumble of letters and numbers. It can't be decrypted. Yet. So instead, this agency or group or standalone hacker stores it, waiting for the day it can be cracked. This is called a harvest now, decrypt later attack. Of course, if we never build a quantum computer capable of breaking public key encryption, we won't have to worry about these harvesting attacks. But there are a few signs that what's known as Q-Day is on the horizon. That's the day a quantum computer is built that's capable of running Shor's algorithm and breaking the internet as we know it.
Today, almost no one hesitates in transmitting bank transactions over their mobile phone.
This is physicist Charles Clark, and he's a big fan of public key encryption.
I think Amazon had something like 8 billion transactions carried out last year. There's no instance reported in which information sent between Amazon and its customers has been effectively listened to by a third party. That type of purloining never happens in the modern world.
For 40 years, Charles worked at the National Institute of Standards and Technology in the US, otherwise known as NIST. He was there when the World Wide Web was made public. Email had only recently become a thing when Shor's algorithm came out. So Charles was one of the few people who got polynomial time algorithms for prime factorization dropped in his inbox. And he watched as slowly his colleagues noticed how big a deal Shor's algorithm and its ability to find the factors of large numbers would be.
You know, if you want to say, okay, what does number theory have to do with anything real? I'll just say all of electronic commerce, you know, all of internet security is based on number theory.
NIST is not only home to physicists like Charles. It's also responsible for setting the US standards that keep the internet secure. And the thing keeping everything secure, public key encryption, it suddenly had a use-by date. Q-Day is sometimes called Y2Q because of how similar this impending deadline feels to Y2K.
The Y2K problem is extremely serious.
The computer bug that was expected to cause widespread disruption at the turn of the millennium.
I'm reasonably confident that the risk has been minimised.
By some accounts, Q-Day is a much bigger deal.
Some people turned on personal computers to find odd things happening with the date.
When Shor's algorithm came out, the deadline to Q-Day felt pretty far away.
Now, at the time, there was no quantum computer. No one had any idea how to build one.
But within a year, scientists at NIST had built a quantum gate, one of the first practical steps forward to building a computer. And along with their colleagues at increasingly juiced-up research labs, they took step after step, inching their way closer to building a full-scale quantum computer that could run Shor's algorithm. By 2016, Q-Day was feeling uncomfortably close.
The United States government decided that it had to migrate its existing computer security standards to a new set of standards that would be resistant to quantum attack.
These new standards are algorithms written to replace public key encryption.
And this means eventually transforming the entire information structure of the world. That doesn't happen overnight.
But they had to start somewhere. NIST makes a call out. Q-Day is coming. Bring us your codes that can withstand quantum attack and keep our data safe.
They opened up a competition where anyone could nominate a new algorithm.
Anyone being cryptographers. These are the people who both make and break encryption. They'd already been working this problem for decades, but in 2016, this competition put them head to head. First comes the making part. Dozens of algorithms are submitted for consideration, vying to replace public key encryption. Then the fun part, the breaking gets underway.
It's a very, very collective effort, a long effort.
The scientists are attacking the algorithms to find their weaknesses, just as a hacker would do. According to cryptographer Dr. Sushmita Rouj from the University of New South Wales, it's all pretty cutthroat.
Once you see a design and you put on your attacker's hat and really try to break it, even if it's your friend who has written this algorithm, you still put on that attacker's hat and you try to break it.
From 69, just 26 algorithms advanced to the second round.
It's always playing the devil's advocate and trying to figure out whether it's going to be robust, whether it's going to be secure.
Then, from 26, 7 finalists and 8 alternatives make it to the third round.
The bar was set pretty high from the very beginning because you have to set the bar high.
NIST wasn't just looking for algorithms that would protect your online bank transactions. They needed them to fit within the existing internet. Otherwise, they would slow it down. And even with Q-Day on the horizon, no one is going to go for that.
They should not be able to notice anything. It should be very, very seamless. And that was a very big ask, but a very good ask because no business wants a service to degrade, right?
And finally, in 2022, 6 years after the contest was first announced, the winners of the NIST competition are decided. These algorithms have been built to withstand anything a quantum computer can throw at it. We think. The winning algorithms might make some parts of the internet slower, by milliseconds. Not great, but our data would be protected from quantum attack, which is why some websites are already testing out these winning post-quantum algorithms. It's all happening under the hood, in those software updates that I just keep putting off. But while some institutions and governments have committed to changing over, their systems are far from being quantum safe.
It needs a lot of investment. We need to have proper people in place. You know, it's very time consuming.
And because we don't know when or even if Q-Day will arrive, it's easy to put off.
It's very hard to say when we might get a quantum computer, but what I see from the advances that are happening in the quantum space as well, it's something that we need to do very timely, very soon. I mean, we have to start now.
Before 1994, the question of how to build a quantum computer was largely theoretical, a pie-in-the-sky idea. After 1994, it became a much more practical question. Scientists went to work, and they finally had the investment behind them. We have made lots of progress. Present day, we do have machines that can run Shor's algorithm. Surprise! But so far, the biggest number a quantum computer has managed to factor on its own is 21. And even I know that's 7 multiplied by 3. We need much bigger machines to break public key encryption, but they're coming. The latest Quantum Threat Timeline report estimates that Q-Day is likely within the next 15 years. Still a while away, but Army scientist Henry Everett thinks that's a good thing.
The people who are frustrated that it's taken a generation are not the same people who are relieved that it's taken a generation because of the threat that it posed. So it's given us time to catch up.
Do you think that we are going to get there? Do you think we are going to have a quantum computer that works and can do the things that we hope it can?
Yeah, I think so.
If Henry seems hesitant, it's because there's another problem weighing on his mind, beyond the task of building a fully functional quantum computer. Computers need algorithms to run. Otherwise, they're just very expensive hunks of metal. After Shor's algorithm arrived on the scene in a flash of poetry, there was this idea that there would soon be dozens more algorithms that would be equally as game-changing. That just hasn't been the case.
There have been very few new algorithms, none of the caliber of Shor's algorithm, that have come out in this time. I'm very surprised at that outcome.
There are some, but 30 years on, Shor is still the algorithm at the top of everyone's list. And really, it creates a problem rather than solving one.
My hope is in the basket of algorithms that have yet to be discovered that could run on that computer someday to solve our unique problems, problems that so far have evaded us.
The US defense industry spent more than $750 million on quantum technologies in the last financial year alone. But we don't have a full-scale quantum computer yet. We don't have a stack of algorithms that can run on them yet.
I have to say that what for me has been maybe the most remarkable thing over this 32 years since Shor's algorithm came out, has been that we have sustained the research in this area for that long. People's patience is not that long, typically. There's clearly will to explore this, or we would have dropped it a long time ago. I hope that the juice is worth the squeeze here.
What a squeeze. We've been squeezing for 30 years.
Yes, indeed.
In episode 3, we'll take a look inside a quantum computer. How does it work? What are the challenges? And why has it taken so damn long to actually build a useful one? We'll also meet one of the physicists that led the way, turning Australia into an unexpected quantum powerhouse. He's not your average physicist.
I was a seaman officer and a diver in the Royal Australian Navy.
Bob was a superhero. In the early days of quantum computing, when not many people were working on it, he was flying back and forth between Australia and the United States multiple times a year. I don't know how he did it.
Bob was amongst the first to ask, how do you build a quantum computer? How do you even begin to control the unpredictable?
How do you build this entity, this Frankenstein, that will come alive? It requires incredible amounts of precision and perfection that will push us to the limits. If this thing is built, it will be a miracle to behold. Truly one of the most astounding things that humankind has achieved of its own, because of the control that's required is rivaled only by what God did in creating the universe. I can't wait to see it come to pass.
Science Friction, Dead and Alive is a special series for ABC Radio National. It was made on the lands of the Wurundjeri, Gadigal and Menang Noongar people. It's reported and presented by me, Jacinta Bowler. Our producer is Fiona Pepper. Our senior producer is Shelby Trainer, and our sound engineer is Tim Jenkins. You can follow Science Friction on the ABC Listen app to hear more. Thanks for observing.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.